Welcome to Stoma and Continence Conversations from Coloplast Professional. I'm Paul.
And I'm Karen. We know stoma and bowel and bladder issues impact the lives of those that you care for.
We're here to support your educational needs and help you in supporting your patients.
We're talking to fellow healthcare professionals and experts by experience to discuss the latest hot topics in the worlds of stoma, continence care and specialist practice.
You're once again joining me in conversation with Professor White. This is the second part of our continuing conversation with Craig about having the conversations with patients and about adjusting to life with a stoma and the internal conflicts that they may be experiencing. To begin, I asked Professor White to talk about how we, as specialist nurses and healthcare professionals, can be more aware of how we help our patients through reflecting on our own experiences.
I'm much more inclined now, 30 years into my career as a clinical psychologist, to open a request to assess somebody with a question that says, what's not happening for you in your life currently the way you need and want it to? As opposed to if you'd looked at me maybe 25 years ago, you'd have potentially a range of questionnaires, questions that would be in the past week, have you felt sad, low or depressed? Have you been bothered by feeling anxious or panicky in particular situations? Are there things that you're avoiding or not doing as much as you used to? Now, those are all particularly helpful and appropriate questions, but they come from a different standpoint. And I think increasingly, certainly in my profession and with the theory and the research behind that, there is more of a recognition about the importance of process. Yes, there's much to commend that, and it is an important part of having a range of ways of eliciting information through structured questionnaire, observation, what people are saying. But there is that thing around what's not happening the way you need and want it to now that you're 6 weeks since your surgery, or what's not happening the way you need and want it to in relation to your relationship. Or, you know, would it be okay if we've talked generally around your key relationships in your life? We know from research, and I know from my career, that there are some people where they become dissatisfied with sex and intimacy. I don't know anything about that, how important that was to you before you were unwell. Is it okay if I ask a bit about that? If somebody says, yeah, that's fine, and then you're into the conversation around, is there anything not happening in the way that you need and want it to at the moment that it may be helpful to discuss? And then what you're into is, again, knowing from the research, the huge potential of nurse specialists for significant positive impact in this area because of the appliance itself, confidence with the appliance, body confidence in general. And then the impact on sex and intimacy is being addressed through that exploration and that natural dialogue that we talked about. I think the other two things that come to mind are around the need to be aware that for some people, there will actually be a significant improvement in sexual functioning, satisfaction with sexual function and elements of intimacy. So, for example, and the example that's often quoted in some of the literature and research is somebody with worsening inflammatory bowel disease whose relationship quality, frequency of sexual intercourse, sexual functioning, intimacy is declining. The more debilitating their condition's becoming, the more it's interfering with day-to-day life. So again, it's important to not find ourselves going into our tried and tested ways of thinking, right, okay, you know, 6 weeks post-operatively, right, okay, their sexual functioning is going to be adversely affected. That may not be the case. And I think the other thing in terms of we're talking about what as professionals we can do to create the conditions for people to articulate and describe and explore and I suppose become observers and be curious themselves on things that they may not have paused to think about. So most people, although they might be saying that they feel dirty or unclean, or that they've got this worry that something awkward or untoward is going to happen, sexual or intimate situations, it's unlikely that when that happens, they will think, I'll pause and I'll think about the main emotions that show up when that happens, or I'll think about how that relates to what I thought about myself as a person before this happened to me, or what I notice I'm thinking I need to do or not do. So again, never underestimating the impact of the curious questions and encouraging people to become observers of themselves. There's a metaphor that's sometimes used in process-based psychological intervention, and it's based on be the chess board, not the chess pieces. So often what happens when we experience a concern or a negative or painful emotion or thoughts is that we become engaged in that sort of chess game. So we become the pieces, we become aware of moves on the board, what we're going to move next, will that result in success or defeat? And that metaphor that's sometimes used around encouraging people to connect with the what's called the observing self. So there's always a part of us there that has the capacity to notice. So interestingly, that part of me, even though I'm thinking about what to say next to you and speaking to you, was the part of me that noticed that I had a frog in my throat a moment ago. I mean, that didn't derail what I was saying, but there's a part of us that's always got the capacity to notice what's happening. And so some of these conversations with openness and curiosity, it's encouraging people to be the chessboard and observe that. And again, not to underestimate the impact of that shift away from the content of our thoughts and emotions and concerns and even bodily physical reactions, to broadening around that context and so that we're able to observe and articulate that to someone else.
Talking about it, you know, being the chessboard rather than the pieces, and it reminds me of something that, going back to my personal practice and reflecting back on my personal practice, you know, I used to get people referred to me, you know, because, you know, surgeon saying, you know, patient isn't coping, or then, you know, that sort of thing. And I used to have to sometimes book them in for 3 clinics before I could work out, or I could get down to what the actual problem they were presenting to me with. I could almost sense what it was, but they used to struggle so much to vocalize what it was. And you had those, and, you know, it was almost that self-preservation, that, you know, that barriers were up. And sometimes it would take me 3 clinic visits. I would be thinking almost questions down the line, or these probes down the line. So it's almost a case of, right, I've almost got to go through that barrier, that discussion, before we can go to the next one, and before we can go to the next one. So it's almost thinking 3 or 4 moves ahead, and then suddenly you almost have that eureka moment. And like you said, a lot of the time the individual either knows the answer or can move forward themselves, but you've almost got to flick that switch for them. It's that self-vocalization of what it is. And as a professional, it's almost that thing of, I get that relief that suddenly we've done it. We're there. We've reached the point where we can actually get into this therapeutic relationship on moving forward, because the individual's there as well with you. And we've both gone on this learning journey together. And as stoma nurses, we do see people at their lowest. We see people when they're at their lowest, when they're at their most vulnerable. And we do build that really strong relationship. And I think, as you said, whether we're talking about sexual relationships, whether we're talking about everybody's wants, their needs, their desires, I think as stoma nurse specialists, we are in an incredibly privileged situation to actually be able to go on a lot of that journey with that individual and see how they can do it. But also, we've got to be aware and, again, be reflective and be emotionally aware of the barriers to that as well. You know, it's the individual we are. You know, we've got to take care of our emotions and our emotional well-being as well, of not taking all of the individual's problems, concerns on board, which I've seen quite a few stoma nurses do, and not just stoma nurses, but nurses do as well, as you're going on that journey with the individual. So it's just really, again, your thoughts on that as well, about, you know, these journeys that people can take, you know, and again, and like you've said, whether we're talking about the sexual function, and it's actually, it improves, you know, it's that really big thing. So whether we're looking at the negatives, you know, and that sort of thing, but look for the positives as well.
As individual professionals and the people that we're providing care, support, intervention and treatment to, the concept of problem-solving mind is one that we're coming back to. From an evolutionary and neurobiological perspective, as human beings, problem-solving mind exists and is constantly whirring around in the background and developed as a way of keeping us safe from threat and danger. And so, being aware of problem-solving mind, so the chess pieces that are playing the game of solving the problem, working out, is it going to be in this conversation today that this makes sense to me, makes sense to them? Is it going to be next time? Is it the next question that I ask? Sometimes being aware that can disconnect us from what's in front of us, both in terms of ourselves and the person, is important. Because it may be that through creating just a bit of space and distance from problem-solving mind as professionals, we are able to notice subtle changes. It may be tone of voice, it could be body posture, that we may not otherwise have noticed, because we're thinking around, what am I going to ask next? If I ask this, will that mean that I won't need to visit next week? Or what, a visit next week, then we'll do such and such. And we might miss something that's important, which could be something like visiting somebody or somebody attending a clinic to say, oh, it was a pleasure to meet with your partner, your wife or your husband last time. Was there anything that you talked about afterwards that you wanted to bring up today? And it may be at that point, there's a subtle change in body posture, or there's a sigh or something like that, that with a bit of space from problem-solving mind, you notice, and then you're able to say, I noticed when I asked you that your shoulder slumped down, or that was a really big sigh that you gave when I asked that. That can then be sufficient for people to say, I'm just so worried about the relationship, I don't think they find me attractive anymore. Or, you know, the relationship's changed now so much because they're caring for me. So there's something about being aware of being in the moment, in that conversation, in that care encounter, being aware as a professional that your mind will constantly be whirring around what you're hearing, how it links with your professional knowledge and experience. That's important, but it's also important to be aware that sometimes being more like the chessboard, observing your own emotional reactions. If there is an emotional change, might that be something that's happening that you're seeing, or that you then want to bring into the encounter in that way? And thinking about what you'd said about it may take a number of interactions or a number of visits before something makes sense to you as a professional or to the person. And our earlier description about creating the conditions with the plaster cast, that innate capacity that we all have to reorganize might happen in one conversation. This is an example that comes to mind from some time ago. I was once asked to assess someone who, if you look at this from a diagnostic classification point of view, as a lot of mental health services will still consider people in this way, and it's probably another discussion for another day, but around my views around whether that has actually helped us develop progressive, sustainable and impactful mental health services or not. But somebody who was described as severe depressive disorder, unresponsive to a range of interventions, And through that open and curious exploration around the person's experience, it transpired that the person had recently had a birthday. That birthday meant they were the same age at which a first-degree relative had died suddenly some years previously. That had started to significantly influence their thoughts and emotions and memories and predictions about their own life, the length of it, what it was going to involve. And simply through that curious exploration around, how do you think what you've just told me about turning the same age as your brother relates to what you were saying earlier? So I didn't seek to impose how I thought it related to it, but I asked, how do you see those two things as going together? That question was sufficient for that inner reorganization process, that awareness, to in fact result in a huge reduction in the intensity, severity, and impact of what was being described as treatment-resistant depression. You don't know when that's going to happen, when asking that question might lead to that connection. It might have been, and I can think of other people I've seen, where 25 outpatient appointments down the line, there is a realization that events X, which occurred 16 years ago, has given me the same bodily sensations as this illness, as this surgery, as this interaction with this surgeon, whatever it is. And it is, again, being aware of our own expectations around, and this is particularly difficult in a healthcare delivery system that's stretched, where there are workforce issues, where there are the demands professionally of the COVID-19 pandemic. There can be a real challenge in terms of, do I have the time? Do I have the emotional energy or confidence to offer further time to explore this? Now, you'd expect me to say this given my professional background, but I don't think that waiting what might seem to be more legitimate nursing or specialist nursing activity over what we're talking about today is appropriate, nor consistent with the research evidence, and if I was being really pushed, I say, nor is it consistent with the NMC code, despite what, you know, narrative might build up around it in terms of, so what, you spent 2 hours just talking about that, when we've got these people that need this assessment done or that assessment done. But that just talking, that open and curious exploration, A, it might be the first time that the person in their lifetime has felt able to trust and feel safe to talk about that and to explore and consider how it impacts around what they need and want, or what's not happening in the way they need and want it to, for that to open up possibilities in ways that have never happened before. And that in itself is potentially sufficient to, if we're going to look at this from a healthcare burden or from a resource utilization point of view, that could significantly impact upon that person's further requests of, encounters with, and needs from the health system in the future. Now, the evidence around that impact is there. And I suppose the more there are these sorts of professional podcasts and discussions about this, and the more professionals and clinical nurse specialists feel confident and supported by their professional peers like you and the team at Coloplast, that the more they're able to advocate and say, well, I appreciate that you want me to put greater importance on this and not do this. However, the evidence and my experience and my professional advice is that I need to spend 3 hours over the next few months with this person, because having listened to them and explored what's not happening the way they need and want, I know that I have nursing evidence and nursing expertise around some interventions that I can explore with them that might help with that, and where there's good research evidence around that. And I also know from research that exploring these sorts of concerns is going to enable the person to reconnect with some of the areas that have become entangled or problematic since they became unwell.
And that's it for part two. This episode really focused on self-reflection and how we communicate with ostomates and how we can support the individuals under our care. Make sure you join us for the third and final installment of my conversation with Professor Craig White. Stoma and Continence Conversations is brought to you by Coloplast Professional. To learn more, visit coloplastprofessional.co.uk.